Hey there, this is Brett. It is Friday, July 17th. Every Friday, almost every Friday, like two out of four Fridays, I like to do a little preview of our supporter-only content in this presentation, Free Bonus Friday. What you're about to hear, you were supposed to hear 2 weeks ago. It didn't get posted for some reason, some kind of technical difficulty. So you're hearing it today. And you know what? We don't need to do a whole new monologue. This show already has a monologue. Here it is.
Revolutionary politicians had to cultivate public opinion, play to the gallery, and establish their authenticity in the eyes of their audiences. Their speeches, their actions, their conduct were subjected to an unprecedented level of public scrutiny, above all by the revolutionary press. The new men who came to the forefront of political life were obliged to negotiate this changed landscape in which their own ambition was considered as inherently suspicious, and their true identity always subject to interrogation. A would-be political leader was meant to be transparent and honest. His political participation should not be conducted behind closed doors, where public opinion could not judge his sincerity. There should be no gap between what he said, his discourse, his words, and what he did. Hence, there was a real demand to know about their private lives, because their private lives were supposed to show that they were authentically good revolutionaries. And from that reason, there was nothing really that you could keep secret. So things which could arouse suspicions, injudicious choice of friends, living behind high walls in a palace, all that could be seen as suspicious. Anything that suggested personal ambition or corruption or love of luxury, for example, whom you dined with, what you ate and where you ate, all these could be perilous. It could form case for denunciation that you were a conspirator. So this need to appear to be a man of virtue was relentlessly demanding, and the attempt to do so involved the Jacobin leaders in a lived contradiction, one in which the reality of their lives and the way in which they actually practiced politics could never match up to the identity they professed. And they always had to be careful that a gap might open up between what they said and what they did, because this gap could be dangerous. And how could they ever prove, in fact, how could any politician ever prove that he is authentically virtuous as opposed to really good at faking it? Now, it's a problem, of course, that our politicians face today, and I'm sure you could think of contemporary examples without me labouring. Can we believe these people? Do we trust what they say? Yeah. But we're all very cynical, and because we live in a democracy and we're used to this. Okay. But people aren't used to it in the late 18th century. They take this stuff very, very seriously. So to have a credible identity as a man of virtue could be a means to power, but it was also a very dangerous path to walk. Whilst revolutionary leaders then depicted themselves as men of virtue, they depicted their opponents in these contrasting terms as conspirators. So this is the other side, virtue on the one hand, the conspirator on the other. These conspirators were said to be in league with France's external enemies, counter-revolutionaries and agents of the foreign powers. Conspiracy was not just a rhetoric, as I've said, because there were also real conspiracies, but at the same time, the narrative of conspiracy was not simply a cynical strategy for destroying enemies. I mean, there certainly was that aspect of it, but it was also indicative of powerful emotions that drove the revolutionary dynamic. And many emotions were intrinsic to revolutionary politics, including anger, suspicion, mistrust, enmity, anxiety, stress, bewilderment, confusion. You know, they were living it, they were experiencing it.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Friday, July 3rd. We are going to travel back to November 2019, and you are going to hear a clip from In Pursuit of Utopia, Episode 5. The title of that episode was The Committee of Public Safety. It was about the French Revolution. We're actually getting ready to record the next installment, the 10th installment of In Pursuit of Utopia, Today, Kevin Cole is going to be joining us again, and we're going to be talking about the Fabian Society, Fabian socialism. So this whole show, this episode 5 of In Pursuit of Utopia, ran almost 2 hours long. You heard the very beginning of the show before I started talking here, and then the clip that you're going to be listening to is from about the 42-minute mark to the 1 hour, 9-minute mark. So you've got 40 minutes of show at least on either side of this clip. For those of you who are intrigued by what you hear on Free Bonus Friday, and then you are maybe you're already a supporter, and you go and you download the show because you never heard it, or you become a new supporter, which lots of people are doing. Free Bonus Friday has been wonderful for bringing new people into our supporter-only content that I will also say is very much in flux right now. There are going to be some new productions. In Pursuit of Utopia is going to go on, but there are going to be some new productions that I'm announcing soon. Our Picture of the Month Club, unfortunately, had to be put on hold for a little while. The show, The Discomfort Zone, has at this point ended. So it's up to me to replace them, one permanently and one temporarily, with things that are just as, if not more, intriguing, exciting, and educational. And I'm hard at work on that. If you want access to this full episode, you can go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV. Or you can simply go to patreon.com/schoolsucks and sign up to contribute $1 per content item. That's what I really appreciate it when people do that. Also, if you are on the website, on the homepage of the website, you will see that our friend Richard Grove, Rich and his students from Autonomy have put together a resource that is a perfect match for what we do at School Sucks. It is called 19 Essential Skills for Success, Not Taught in School. It has a bunch of what I would describe as easy wins, meaning it does not take a lot of time to go through this PDF and you get a lot of valuable information, a lot of shareable information, you know, for your conversations with others about the shortcomings of public schooling and college. There's a link for that in the show notes for today's episode. It is also right in the banner on the homepage at schoolsucksproject.com. So that's it. Please support the School Sucks Project by just gifting yourself some very exclusive, entertaining, and educational content that you will not hear, aside from these little preview clips in the regular podcast feed. schoolsucksproject.com/AV to see all of the support options. So thank you so much for listening. I will talk to you again soon.
You would think that the Illuminists would be more toward the Robespierre types of revolutionaries, right? Tear it all down. Destroy everything.
Okay.
However, as far as I've been able to find it, the revolutionaries that we could even suspect of being Illuminati members all seem to be the constitutional monarchists. They seem to be more moderate. And I think that that indicates a very important philosophical fact or point about both the Enlightenment revolutionaries and the Illuminati.
Well, is it that they were just smart enough to understand what George Washington understood, what John Adams understood, what Alexander Hamilton understood, especially in the context of France, where like the whole participatory politics thing is brand new. So if you could say, all right, well, like, let's not just open the floodgates.
Mm-hmm.
With people who are illiterate, uneducated, desperate, like, let's not just turn society over to them. So if there's a way that we could maybe appear to be on their side, well, I mean, you know, like controlled opposition, that's kind of the idea. This is actually, you know, I always talk about politicians jumping in front of a parade and pretending they're leading it. But after a while, they kind of are leading it, you know, like they can re-steer a parade where it needs to go if they can fool the people behind them into thinking they're the leadership that they want. So,
exactly.
I'm being way too general, but I think that is a consideration of this, that people know just letting France loose to common people is an absolute disaster waiting to happen, just like it would be anywhere where participatory politics is new. And
exactly.
Plus, people are desperate and starving.
Right, right. So I'm doing all this research and I'm joking around that these people are going through gluten withdrawal. So they're entirely insane. There's no way.
Oh, yeah.
They could be making any good decisions. But I honestly do think that what you said is accurate. that if there were an Illuminati presence in the French Revolution, that would have been their approach to kind of take it easy and take advantage of their belief in the progress of humanity, that enlightenment idea, that humanity is moving towards something. So this comports totally with A, the philosophy of Mirabeau, which I already mentioned, which was playing both sides, right? He's getting paid by the king, but he's a leader of the revolution. So, I mean, that's kind of like the stereotypical action of the Illuminati as the common person on the street today might understand it, if they're even familiar, right? Like, what is the Illuminati? Oh, they play both sides.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Mirabeau was actually doing, and he might have actually been an Illuminati member.
Right.
But also, a honest to God, no doubt about it, member of the Illuminati from way back in the early days in Bavaria, this guy, Xavier von Zwack, said, or wrote rather, "We cannot use people as they are, but begin by making them over." Okay, so here we have it again. It's not this sudden pull the plug, we're changing the whole operating system kind of thing. It's this slow, we need to get in there and change the way people are kind of thing. The alteration of human nature. And incidentally, that whole concept is something that features very prominently in the writings of Robespierre, which I think is ironic because he winds up pulling the rug out from everybody toward the end of the revolution, or before he dies anyway. But he actually had a great quote when I'm going to say we're skipping ahead, but I've kind of been all over the place this whole time anyway. So there was a point in the early revolution after the General Assembly. So that was the new government that was established in the tennis court that was abiding by the Declaration of the Rights of Man. They, in a bizarre, almost like really difficult for me to understand or believe move, they decide, hey, you know, we've been in power for about 4 months now. Let's declare war on three countries.
Sure.
So they declare preemptive war on, what is it, Belgium, Austria, and then Prussia declares war on them. It's insane. And so this newly established government, while the king is still legally king, they allow him to continue, but they've placed these constitutional restrictions on him. They engage in a number of foreign wars. And Robespierre in the beginning was actually against going to war. And one of the great things that he said was nobody loves armed missionaries. So his argument that he made to the General Assembly was that basically not everybody's ready for this. Like maybe we good French aristocrats or bourgeois, we're ready for these ideas because we read Voltaire, we read Rousseau, but nobody else is ready for any of this stuff. And if we go over there and try to force our ideals on them, it's only going to cause problems. He was totally right.
And while in the fervor of that surrounds him saying that, and I don't know the answer to this, I'm curious, does that cast him under suspicion by certain people? For because that's like a form of moderation.
Right.
And moderation in these circumstances is seen by many people, especially a group of people who are, operating in a kind of unanimity. They see that as suspicious, right?
Oh, for sure, for sure. And I think that at this point, the just insane fear of somebody being a traitor to the revolution, while it was present, I don't think that it was as bad as it would get. So if it did cast any suspicion on him, I don't think that he got in any particular trouble for it. And what's interesting about Robespierre is he appears to me to have been, like, this guy was just ridiculously committed to his Enlightenment values of democracy and the will of the people. He was very much, I think, a collectivist. Right. So he was against the war, but then once the war was voted for and they went, he started giving these speeches about, well, here's what we need to do to win. And people were like, what are you talking about, dude? I thought you didn't want this war. And he's like, it was the will of the people. So now we're going to do it. And there were a number of times where that kind of thing came up. Something would be put to vote. He disagreed with it, but it passed anyway. And so he just changed his mind. I'm with the people.
That's commitment.
That is commitment. It's a whole new kind of commitment.
And there must have been some discussion about this, like, will of the people idea, even like skepticism had to come about even in those circles, like sooner than later, like closer to 1789 than the end of this whole thing, where it's like, these people, the will of these people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because what happens, going back to the beginning of the revolution, but of course, continuing all the way through, but even in the beginning, as I said, people were largely protesting against this feudal system, a very medieval system, for different reasons. Of course, the nobles wanted, or the bourgeois wanted political representation, whereas the peasants wanted food. Medieval problems require medieval solutions.
Yeah.
Pretty much immediately, what starts happening? Heads on pikes. It's straight out of the 1381 Peasants' Revolution from in London. You know, like, this is stuff that you think of people in tunics, speaking Latin, yeah, and heads on pikes lining London Bridge.
Yeah,
that was going on in France in the era that, you know, in the Age of Enlightenment, right? This is the peak of civilization. The governor, when they stormed the Bastille, which is a very famous event of the early revolution, because, you know, you got to give these people props. They understood that when the government becomes oppressive, you got to stockpile. So they went around and they stole every gun they could find. I'm talking about the peasants and the bourgeois. They stole every gun they could find, but they didn't have any gunpowder. Where's all the gunpowder? It's in this gigantic medieval dungeon in the center of Paris called the Bastille. In French, it's Bastille. Call it the Bastille. So to make a long story short, the Third Estate winds up storming this dungeon. And when they get their hands on the warden, if you will, they carve his head off, mount it on a bayonet, and put on a parade. And yeah, they march through town with his head on a pike.
What year is this? I'm not...
The Bastille was 89, I think. Let me double check that just so we can be totally sure. But it is very early on. And what's interesting about it, yep, 89, July 14th, 89.
Okay.
When Thomas Jefferson heard about the storming of the Bastille, he wound up sending 60 francs to every widow whose husband had died in the event when they actually took this dungeon. Thomas Jefferson was an American who was highly, highly in favor of the French Revolution, even once it had become violent. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
So this, I think, there's a larger pattern in the French Revolution that really interests me, and I've already mentioned parts of it, which is that we're talking about progress that in England, and therefore in the United States, sort of took place over a long period of time where political and societal evolution could take place. People, they got their mild representation with the Magna Carta, then they got their parliament, and these ideas just began to saturate the culture. And so then later on, when more revolutionary people come around and say, hey, we want more freedom, it's easier to swallow. But in France, it's just boom, all at once. Like in your university, Michael Malice said, you guys talked about the red pill, and he said, take the red pill, but don't take the whole bottle.
Yeah.
Well, France took the whole damn bottle.
Yep. Yep.
The whole thing. And so, you know, this is the trouble for us to look back on it, where there are plenty of ideals in the revolution that we probably agree with. Yeah. You know, everyone's hungry, and I don't think we're in favor of a rich monopolistic class saying that God told them that they deserve all the bread and you don't. So sure, yes, revolt, do something, take up arms if that's what it takes. But it gets hairy when the new revolutionaries, they say, okay, well, now we're going to establish a new government. And, well, who's in charge of that? And this is where the trouble comes from. At first, it's this General Assembly who believe in constitutional monarchy. So guys like Lafayette, they elected the very first mayor ever of Paris. And he was, if not running the General Assembly, he was one of the prominent administrators. But this guy was a noblest. I mean, he was perfectly in favor of there being a king. But then more revolutionary people from perhaps the lower element of the Third Estate, they were starting to murmur things about, well, why do we even need a king? Yeah. We can take care of ourselves. They had grown to resent the nobility. So it was, in the minds, I think, of the masses, it was becoming more of an emotional issue of resentment as opposed to some sort of ideological crusade.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many psychological ills in play in this thing. And I mean, this is as good of time as any. It could be injected at any point in this conversation. But you turned me on to this historian, Marissa Linton, right? And I think the title of her book was Conspiracy and Terror in the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she talks about there's like this hyper vigilance and paranoia just at not even just in this Third Estate, just in, you know, all the common people. It goes up all the way to the French court. And like even talking about Mirabeau, right, and all his dealings that might be in conflict with the role he's supposed to be playing as somebody in the French government. Their upper class is very factionalized, right? And when you have competing factions with varied interests, that's a breeding ground for conspiracy theory, for schemes, and political instability right there, right? So you have political instability at the top, and you mentioned this, that there's like a defection of nobility from the safety of nobility to support the cause of the revolution, right? At least in some pockets. But one of the things, I was listening to a lecture that she gave, and again, the name of her book was Conspiracy and Terror in the French Revolution, excuse me, Marissa Linton. She was saying that once people showed ambition as like revolutionary leaders, they were exposed to a very, very high level of scrutiny. And when she, in her talk, talked a lot about the primary sources that she had encountered, mostly in the form of like journals of people who are actually on the ground, people who might have even been victims of some of the violence or firsthand witnesses of some of the violence, and certainly people who were present throughout the 1790s in France, lots of familiar behavior, right? Like prying into the personal lives of people, looking for impurity, right? So that's another term that's used a lot during the revolution, is it's like a virtue-led kind of thing. And what is it to be a man of virtue? And anybody who shows any ambition in being a leader or prominent figure in any way in this is subjected to a kind of virtue or purity test. There's lots of guilt by association, and I think there's these are just timeless features of ideological extremists. But social justice warriors, as they're called, are a very small group of people, right? The people acting out these ideas, whether they're just in violent or hysterical ways, they are the most unwell people who believe those ideas, but they're an effective barometer for the ideas that are in lots of people's heads. And maybe a lot of those people are just too complacent or passive or properly adjusted, whatever that means, not unwell enough to throw garbage cans or scream whatever other behaviors we see from groups like Antifa, right?
Right.
Like that is just unwellness, right? It's the merging of ideas and unwellness. But you can look at that small group of unwell people and say, all right, well, that gives me an understanding, like in the case of higher education, if these people, through their unwellness, are being animated to a certain extent by ideas, even though they might have been acting all unhinged for some other reason, if not for these ideas, if the idea is the motivation for that behavior, and they'll say it is, right? They're usually like holding a sign and chanting something. It's a good indication of the ideas that are being fed into the heads of many people who are just more complacent and aren't going to act out that way. So it's like a very effective measure of not a widespread psychological condition, but a widespread ideological condition. So you have certainly the desperation because of the disparity in class, starvation, all of these factors playing into this as well. But you also do see the way that the rhetoric does just continually crank up the heat of this whole thing, right? And because there's this scrutiny, this paranoia, I think you see this natural progression to the dehumanization of any political opponents, right? Whether they're intra-revolutionary, right? Because that starts to factionalize as well, but also outside of that. And when you have dehumanization, you're going to have violence. So I think that's an interesting feature in play here as well.
For sure, for sure. And another aspect of the dehumanization, as well as just the general paranoia, was it wasn't just a fear that somebody might be a traitor to the revolution, or maybe they're an aristocrat who's secretly working for the king. There was also this constant myth really floating around that there was a foreign conspiracy, right? The Austrians were coming and they were going to assassinate the revolutionary leaders and put the king back in power. That was why they went to these foreign wars, is they were afraid that the other monarchical powers surrounding France were going to see the revolution as a threat to their own crowns and invade.
And it's interesting, like there's perhaps a shred of truth to that, right? Like there's more than just smoke, kind of like the Red Scare here. You know, that there's communist infiltration and it becomes like a cartoon because it got so out of hand. But there was, you know,
right.
the people who were trying to sound that alarm, and like through like the House Un-American Activities Committee or McCarthyism, certainly went too far. And the left obviously uses that as like, oh, look at right wingers. They're so paranoid about everything. There was communist infiltration. There was a foreign conspiracy. There almost always is in any sort of upheaval like this.
Right.
At the very least, in the form of interest, and then maybe trying to tilt things a certain way for the benefit of, I don't know, a competing nation. Like, that's more than plausible. But yeah, there is. I mean, we've already talked about that. There is some of that happening here.
Yeah. So this paranoia, I think, eventually culminates later on, of course, in what's called the Reign of Terror, when so many people are being rounded up and being accused of being traitors to the revolution. So at this point, well, the king is killed. I want to get the exact day, because there is a point in the revolution where the timeline really does come down to like what month something happened as opposed to what year, because it all really happened quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see, Louis the 16th. Okay. It was 93 that he was killed. The Republic, the first Republic, I believe, was declared just before that, because Robespierre had said that for the Republic to survive, the king must die. And this was an example of Robespierre changing his mind again. For the majority of his life, he had been very adamantly against capital punishment. But once they had decided that the king was no longer a viable member of the citizenry because he had tried to escape, he said, we need to kill him. That's it. We can't have him around anymore. And of course, from then on, lots of people wind up dying. So when people are rounded up and accused of being traitors to the Republic, they're thrown in jail, but then there get to be so many prisoners that the people who aren't in prison are like, there are so many prisoners, man. What if they just kind of rise up against us? Like, there could be a whole nother revolution of them against us.
Yeah.
So they just started killing them. And there's an example again of that conspiracy idea, that dehumanization, where these vile monarchists, many of them weren't monarchists, but these horrible traitors to the Republic are going to do something to us. And so we need to take preemptive action, and it's for the greater good. And that's the ultimate theme. I know I'm jumping around a lot in the history of this. I have not adhered to a timeline as I guess I would have liked to.
It's more adventurous this way.
It is.
I think. It's how I understand that it's helpful. It's like, it's comforting to work along a timeline. The good news is that most people already have some idea of what happened. Like, a people's revolution that ultimately concludes with an emperor. It's like the verdict is clear. Most people, even in their public school education, know that the French Revolution preceded the rise of Napoleon, that it was not successful. I think this discussion is just a matter of what went wrong and why. And if, wrong is such a judgmental word. I feel like in all of these kinds of conflicts, there's like this impulse to assign blame. I was actually talking about this with it's sort of just like an approach to understanding something without wisdom, right? Like, the first thing you want to do is say, whose fault is this?
Right.
You know what I mean? I could do that. I mean, there's people I could point at, but I'm more talking here about the actual people who are animating this event, right? Who do they blame? And that is always so much easier. Even in the end, it's always so much uglier and more difficult. But in the beginning, when you're trying to understand what's happening, it's so much easier to just say, who's to blame and what do we do about them? And right. That seems to be what happens here. So as somebody like looking at this as an event, I try to resist that impulse. But it doesn't mean that you can't like look at things happening in French society and say, that's a factor, that's a factor, that's a factor, right? Like, cause and effect does exist. And just obviously, if you have such a socially stratified society, it is going to be extremely low trust. And that's, again, what Linton is talking about. There is so much paranoia. There's so much fear. There's so much suspicion, because despite what the alt-right will tell you, a homogenous society does not necessarily mean a harmonious society. And when you have that kind of class stratification so visible with people not literally like on top of each other, but in close proximity, like was the case in France, you're going to have a very paranoid, very low trust kind of culture emerge from that.